Thanks for the applause. First of all, you have to bear with me a little bit because I've got a bit of a tight chest. So I got to chew chewing gum. I mustn't get too excited. It's a bit of a problem because the Civil War's a bit exciting. But anyway, if I start coughing and can't continue, I'm sure Ben will continue here for me. The English Civil War, well, the whole period of the English Revolution, really, starts in 1640 and ends up in 1660 with the restoration of the monarchy. I would say it's one of the key periods in British history, which has enormous lessons for us today. It shows a different side, if you like, of the temperament of the British, or the English, I should say. Trotsky wrote a pamphlet called Where is Britain Going? And in the pamphlet, he says that the British working class has two traditions. On the one hand, one of servitude. On the other hand, one of militancy and revolution. And he urged the British communists at that time to carry out a thorough study, particularly of Chartism, which was the first workers' movement in the whole of the world, but also to carry out a study of the English Civil War, in particular the army of Oliver Cromwell, the New Model Army, which was much more than an army. It was a political party, a revolutionary party. As in the French Revolution and also the American Revolution, you have a left wing of the revolution. You even have a communist wing of the revolution. And really, we stand on the shoulders of these individuals. In other words, the fight to emancipate ordinary people, common people, is not a new thing, but goes back a long, long way. The British ruling class doesn't like to refer to the period as the English Revolution. Its official name is the Great Rebellion. It was a far more light-hearted affair, a bit of a putsch, in 1688, where one section of the ruling class exchanged their seats for another section of the ruling class, where the masses were not involved at all. But the British ruling class has called this the Glorious Revolution. As you probably are aware, the Civil War has always been described as a conflict between Parliament and the Crown, a conflict between the Ironsides, as the parliamentary forces were called, the Roundheads. And the reason why they were called Roundheads is because of the apprentices in London who supported the parliamentary cause, and they had cropped hair, they had all their hair shaved. The Royalists, on the other hand, were called the Cavaliers, and they had very long hair, very big hats. And the word cavalier is a distortion of the Spanish word caballero. And the caballeros were horsemen in Catholic Spain who hunted down the Protestants. You know, to appreciate and to understand the events of this period, which marked the transformation of British society from the medieval society to the beginnings of a modern society, we have to see in the context of the crisis of Europe itself. There was 100 years or more crisis prior to the English Revolution, characterized by uprisings, economic decay, wars, dislocation. You had a growth of religious sects, religious sectarianism, particularly after the Reformation, when Martin Luther nailed his proposition to the church door. I think it was in 1517, if I'm not mistaken. And the growth of Protestantism reflected the crisis within religion itself and reflected the morality and outlook of the rising bourgeoisie at the time. But this crisis, which was written about actually by Alan Woods in an article he did on Hieronymus Bosch some months ago, where there was widespread feeling in society, given the breakdown of society, that this was the end of the world. We had religious fanaticism developing, and the growth of the flagellant movement. They beat themselves, they walked down the streets, beating themselves until they were bleeding. This was not the end of the world, but the dying of an old system, the dying of feudalism, the crisis of feudalism. I won't give too many quotations because it's very difficult to translate Old English, even for me, I understand it. But there was an English preacher in 1643 at the beginning of the English Civil War who explained what people were feeling at the time. He said, "These days are days of shaking. And this shaking is universal. It's universal in the Palatinate, Bohemia, Germania, Catalonia, Portugal, Ireland, and England." In other words, there was a universal feeling that the whole world has been shaken upside down, turned upside down by these events. The significance of the English Revolution is the same significance as the French Revolution, that it was a social revolution. It was a bourgeois revolution against the old order of feudalism. It's always depicted in this period that the religion played a very important role, which is true. The Catholic Church and also the church after the Reformation in England dominated the entire, all aspects of life. It dominated everything from the cradle to the grave. The church was responsible for the education of everybody. The church and the bishops were part of the establishment, were part of the ruling class. They were the largest landowners. As you're probably aware, there was no television, there was no internet, there was no Facebook. So the ruling class had a very, very powerful weapon in their hands called the pulpit. And every Sunday, the preachers would get orders, were to get political orders from the government as what to say and what to explain. In other words, it was a regime of thought control by the feudal regime, the feudalists. And as Engels explained, that the bourgeoisie, if they were going to challenge feudalism, first of all had to challenge the ideological position of the church. There's a famous book in Britain, I don't know if you know it, it's called Religion and the Rise of Capitalism by J.H. Tawney. And the whole book is an explanation how Protestantism, and Puritanism in particular, fitted extremely well to the outlook of the rising bourgeois class, of a strict religion, one of hard work, of individual responsibility. And above all, Protestantism was an essential creed to attack the feudal regime. In Britain, or in England, in 1535, 36, Henry VIII, because he had a few marital problems, decided to break with the Catholic Church and launch the Reformation in England. This was extremely popular because there was general hatred for the church and its greed and its hypocrisy. And there was an enormous tradition of anti-clericalism in Britain, going back, way back to the peasant uprising in 1381 in England, led by a man called John Ball, who was very, very left-wing. And he has a very famous phrase, which I will retranslate. In English, it is, "When Adam delved and Eve span, who then was the gentleman?" But I'll translate it, make it easier. Basically, when Adam and Eve were around, who was the ruling class then? Which makes a lot of sense, doesn't it? But the Reformation in England was very popular, particularly amongst the bourgeois class, because Henry VIII nationalized the church, basically. He took over all the monastic lands, all the monasteries were taken over, and they were completely stripped of lead, of everything that was valuable in them. If you can see them today in England, they are ruins. And the bourgeoisie were happy because they were buying all the church lands very, very cheaply. And this gave rise also to a new layer, a new element of the ruling class, which was called the gentry. The gentry. And they were landlords, but new landlords, bourgeois landlords. They didn't own land like the old nobility and the aristocracy. These were merchants who bought land, and they became very wealthy. And many of these were represented in the House of Commons, because Parliament in England was only represented by the ruling class, the landed ruling class. And whereas you had a House of Lords and a House of Commons, two wings of Parliament, by the time of the Civil War, the Commons was three times richer than the House of Lords. The bourgeoisie also originally in Britain or in England, perhaps we should say more accurately, had become quite wealthy. After all, they were engaged in piracy and all sorts of illegal activities in order to make money, usury. Above all, they liked to employ pirates to attack the Spanish ships, which usually had a lot of gold on them. And these pirates became very famous. Walter Raleigh, which became Sir Walter Raleigh, he was knighted for his work. And Drake, he's another one, he was also knighted. So all the pirates in Britain were knights, they were all knighted because they did great work. But this gold and income flowed into the hands of the merchants and the rising bourgeoisie who bought into land. Incidentally, it's worth knowing that the bourgeoisie originally supported the monarchy. They supported Henry VIII. They supported Elizabeth I. In other words, they supported the absolute monarchies. These were dictatorships, but they provided peace and quiet. They stopped the barons fighting one another. They provided order, law and order. And that's what the capitalists wanted. They wanted law and order to get on with their trading, to get on with their piracy. England itself was under threat, above all, by Spain. Spain was the arch enemy. It was like the most reactionary power in the world, like Tsarist Russia was in the last century, like American imperialism. And there was always enormous conflicts between England, who had become Protestant, and Catholic Spain. Not least because they stole the gold as well. That's another matter. I think all things changed. Well, there was a big event. I forget the date now. It was the Spanish Armada. There were Spanish comrades in the audience. You know when the Spanish Armada took place? 1580. Come on. 1588. There we are. Well done. You get a Mars bar for that. And of course, as you know, the English, who were playing bowls at the time, I understand, in the cliffs of Dover, having a game. We saw them at the Spanish Armada heading up the channel. And and Drake and Raleigh rallied the English meagre forces of the English and defeated them. Amazing. And the significance of this was that Britain was always, or England was always afraid of invasion. Always afraid of invasion. And this very victory meant the security of England. So England was now secure from national invasion from other powers. So the bourgeoisie were very concerned about national security, first of all, and now thought, well, we are now secure. Let's look at the other problems we got. And the main problem they faced was that the superstructure of feudalism was hampering their development, hampering their industry, their trade, and their possible wealth. Even industry and the feudalism, which is very, very weak, was very, very tightly controlled through guilds, masters, guilds, apprentices, very rigidly, upwardly controlled. Above all, if capitalism was to develop, then they needed free labor. They needed a working class. And therefore, they had to break down the restrictions in agriculture and the way in which the land dominated. After all, it was the vast majority was agricultural. At this time, London, I think, was the biggest city in the world. It had 500,000 population. One of the reasons for this was the Enclosure Act, the enclosures that were taking place 100 years previously. It had thrown a lot of the peasantry off the land into the village, into the towns. That sheep rearing actually became the prime source of commercial farming. Sheep. In fact, Thomas More, who was a very famous man who wrote Utopia, commented at the time that these sheep, they'd taken over everywhere. They were so powerful, they even started eating people. Well, figuratively, of course. So the bourgeoisie had a lot of problems under feudalism. The feudal monarchies also imposed monopolies and gave privileges to certain sectors as opposed to others. On the turn of the century, that is in 1603, there was a new monarch, James I of Scotland. And James I represented now a completely, his coming to the throne represented a fundamental change in the outlook of the bourgeoisie in Britain. They liked Henry the previous monarchs, but now there was going to be a clash between them and James I. And although England was a Protestant country, there are different tendencies within Protestantism. There are different schools within Protestantism, where you had Anglicanism, for instance, which is very close to Catholicism. You had Presbyterianism. You had on the left, the most open, if you like, was Puritanism, Calvinism. But even within these broad trends, you had lots of divisions. And the big question has always been for the monarchy, where they get their money from. And that they traditionally had to call Parliament, who just simply rubber stamped anything they particularly wanted, because the Parliament was in favour of the monarchy. But as I explained, things began to change, and James I, who asserted his right as an absolute monarch, very much clashed with the interests of the rising bourgeoisie. And there were a lot of frictions between Parliament and the Crown during his reign. And as a result, James I attempted to circumvent Parliament, go round Parliament, and introduced different legislation to raise money for the Crown, separate from Parliament. They carried out forced loans. They forced people to give loans to the Crown. They increased taxes. They imposed new taxes. And therefore, this led to a violent struggle between Parliament and the Crown itself. Who decides on what money is to be raised and where is it going to be spent? But behind this, clearly, it was a reflection of the bourgeoisie beginning to assert themselves. As I explained, James I created monopolies. He would sell for a lot of money a monopoly position to a certain group of people at the expense of someone else. A classical example is the merchant adventurers, which is a group of bourgeois who managed to have a monopoly situation granted by the monarchy. But with this growing conflict in society between Parliament and the Crown, it stirred up a lot of other feelings. A lot of other issues were being raised. Above all, in the field of religion, where the Puritans were demanding a far more open church, a far more democratic church, more freedom of conscience. And this wasn't a secondary matter, because the church was the main buttress, the main weapon of the feudal regime to keep itself intact. And the pulpit, as I said, was the most important weapon they had at their disposal. So any attempt to weaken this weapon was obviously vigorously resisted by James I and the clique around him. The old feudal classes were also becoming more and more parasitic. This was an epoch of a lot of inflation, a lot of price rises. And whereas the bourgeoisie were able to make money and get very wealthy, the actual old aristocracy, the nobility, was beginning to decline in its influence, but above all in its wealth. And it began to get more and more parasitic itself. It began to look towards the monarchy to provide it, and the court, above all the court, to provide it with different avenues of advancement for his children and so on. In the field of religion, the Puritans wanted to abolish the right of the monarchy to appoint bishops. But the Puritans wanted to elect their own preachers. They wanted a freedom of conscience for people to be able to choose who were their preachers. And as I said, the religion was extremely important. In fact, as far as I remember, the Bible wasn't translated into English until the middle of the 16th century, which is a big advance, because people couldn't read Latin. So they had to rely on the preachers to tell them what was in the Bible. But as soon as the Bible was translated into English, they could read it for themselves. And as you know, as Alan Woods explained, you can get anything from the Bible. You can justify anything. And therefore, they selected from the Bible things that would support their class interests. And James I attacked the Puritans and said, no bishop, no king. In other words, you get rid of the bishops, very soon you'll be getting rid of me. which was pretty much an accurate prediction of what was going to happen. Also in England at this time, there was a growth of English nationalism, which was linked to Protestantism. But the court under James I was very, very accommodating to Catholicism. You know, James didn't pursue the interests of the English against the Spanish, for instance, with any vigor. In fact, it was well known that the Spanish ambassador at court had more influence than most other people. So the king was seen as an appeaser. And it developed, there was a growing hatred against all the different policies that they were pursuing, whether it be in the realm of religion, or politics, or commerce. And when James I died, I think it was in 1625, Charles I came to the throne. And he immediately called the parliament together. And as soon as he called the parliament together, he was bombarded with all these criticisms. So he very quickly dissolved parliament and began to rely on the court, the parasites, and to rely on favoritism. And quite an interesting thing that one of his main advisors was impeached, was removed from the scene, shall we say, one of his main advisors to Charles I. And therefore he became more reliant on his wife, Maria Henrietta from France. Maria Henrietta was brought up as a Catholic, and she was a Catholic, and she made no bones about it that this was the influence she wanted on Charles I. They called a further parliament in 1629. Again, that ended in a real bitter struggle, more bitter than ever before. And Charles I began to implement forced loans. In other words, Parliament wouldn't give him any money; he would take the money. Incidentally, just in relation to the wives question, there's a similar pattern in relation to the French Revolution and the Russian Revolution, as we know. All the wives were generally foreign wives and were very reactionary and had a great deal of influence over the monarch. So Charles decided to levy taxes. Only problem was that people weren't prepared to pay them. So he imprisoned people for non-payment of taxes. So this led to a big, as you said, clash in Parliament, who demanded that the king himself accept the supremacy of Parliament in relation to finance. They also passed resolutions in support of a more aggressive foreign policy and a more open religion. But Charles I had enough of this. He just said, that's the end of it. And for the next 11 years, right up to the end, to the Civil War, 11 years, he refused to call any Parliament whatsoever and just ruled through his own absolute monarchy. So he went on to continue to collect more taxes, illegal taxes of this sort, such as ship money and other forms of taxation. And in these 11 years of dictatorship, the bourgeoisie were more and more and more angry at the situation. They were angered. But it wasn't simply the bourgeoisie. Charles managed to alienate everybody. And in 1637, when John Hampden, who was one of the leaders of the Parliament, refused to pay his taxes, he was arrested and imprisoned. So the bourgeoisie went on strike. There would be no taxes paid. And they tried to force Charles to recall Parliament. But the turning point was in 1640, when there was a revolt in Scotland. And in order to raise an army, he needed finance. Charles needed finance badly. So he was forced to call one Parliament. It lasted 3 weeks. Then he shut it down. It went down in history as the Short Parliament. But very quickly he realized that it was untenable. He was in an impossible position. So he had to recall Parliament once again. And before Parliament would grant any money to the king, they demanded certain guarantees and certain injustices would be put an end to. And his chief minister, Lord Stafford, was impeached. Yeah, impeached. He was found guilty by Parliament. And he was beheaded. Archbishop Laud was also impeached, and he was imprisoned. And a few years later, he was beheaded. Gets exciting now. They demanded that the courts, the feudal courts that had been established, which the names were the Star Chamber and High Commission, These are the ones which decided to torture people, and they were very, very powerful courts under the control of the monarchy. They were now to be abolished. Parliament said these should be abolished. During the Parliament, there was a revolt also in Ireland. So the king requested money to raise an army to go to Ireland. But first of all, they didn't trust him with the money. And above all, they didn't trust him with an army. Because once he'd raised an army, he could come and close down Parliament again. So they weren't happy with this. And in November 1641 came the final break in the situation. The parliamentary opposition drew up a document. It was called the Grand Remonstrance. Grand Remonstrance. I don't know what the hell a remonstrance is, but it was grand. And basically, it was a catalogue of all the crimes that Charles I had committed since he came on the throne. Huge list of them. 200 of them. Yeah? And they basically demanded that the crown, that the king, be subordinate to Parliament. And that bishops, which were the key basis of support for the monarchy, should be abolished. Now this created a massive row in the Parliament, in the House of Commons. I even heard that there were swords drawn as well, you know. Things would get into a point of no return, because there was one little clause in this Grand Remonstrance, which had never been heard of before, that this document should be printed and made public. Now, this was going too far. By this time, Charles I had gathered against him everybody. The entire ruling class, if you like, were against what he was doing. Led by the bourgeoisie, obviously. The gentry in Parliament. And now they were split over the vote for this document. Because it was the nobles who were there, realised, and also the big bourgeois who had a lot of property, realised that things had come to the edge of an abyss for them. And there was no longer a debate in Parliament, closed doors, no one knew about it, a debate amongst the ruling class. But as we know, the first condition of revolution is a split in the ruling class. And they managed to pass this resolution by a majority of 11 votes. As one said, and I'll translate it from Old English, if we make equality in the church and abolish these bishops, we will come to equality within the Commonwealth. In other words, you'll have equality in society. But these ideas, in other words, are extremely dangerous. They'd be the slippery slope in which it opens up, everything opens up. And finally, that was in November, in January, Charles I attempts to arrest the parliamentary leaders for treason. He brings an armed guard to the House of Commons. But these people left by the back door. They went out the back door. And they went into the city of London, which was quite a bed of opposition to the monarchy, of radicalism. At this stage, Parliament basically collapsed, and the royalists withdrew. And the king left London and went to Oxford to try and rally his supporters. So in 1642 is the beginning of the Civil War. And if you look at a map of Britain, which indicated the support for the royalists and the parliamentarians, you will see that the monarchy is supported by the north and the west. In other words, the most feudal, backward areas supported the monarchy. And the parliamentarians were supported above all by the south and the southeast of England, the most prosperous areas, where the bourgeoisie were strongest. So while the monarchy was supported by the aristocracy, the nobility, and all the forces that they could gather around them, even some of the common people, they were retainers in relation to feudalism. If you're a lord, then all those people who held land by you should follow you. Those who supported the parliamentary side were often described, I won't quote it now, I haven't got time, as the middling sort, the middle types. Above all, this is like the petty bourgeois, if you like. Sort of independent farmers, yeomen, craftsmen, apprentices, small traders. This was the backbone of support for the parliamentary side. It's interesting you see a split, not just between the royalists and the parliamentarians. You also see a split within the parliamentary ranks. In other words, you have the big bourgeoisie, who had extensive property and wealth and didn't want to lose it. They were more conservative. They were saying, well, hang on, yes, we want to change things, but, you know, let's have a compromise. You know, they were afraid of losing their own position, the material position they had. Whereas the petty bourgeois had very little property, really. They've had no hesitation about of driving forward and being the most audacious and fighting things to the end. In fact, if it wasn't for the mass and the petty bourgeois mass, the radicalized mass, there wouldn't have been a revolution anyway. The big bourgeoisie would have given in, as it did eventually in 1660. Now, the history of the Civil War is quite interesting, very, very interesting. First of all, the parliamentary side tried to organize an army on the traditional model, you know, the traditional retainers and officers, which were, you know, top landlords, lords, you know, very traditional type of organization. And that traditional form of the organization faced the royalist armies, and above all, the royalist cavalry. The point is, the royalists were very used to riding about on horses. In fact, their leader was a man called Prince Rupert from Germany. And he was a very dashing officer. He rallied the royalists and the cavalry particularly to lambast the parliamentary side. And as a result, the royalists nearly won the Civil War. But there's one little fact that changed all that. And the fact that his name was Oliver Cromwell, who was a farmer, an independent farmer in East Anglia, in the east of Britain. He was a member of Parliament. And he independently organized in his area a division, a cavalry division. And he made a call for all those independent farmers to come with him. And he adopted a different method. He thought that the only way we were going to defeat the king was on the basis of a revolutionary war against the king. And above all, he wanted freedom or toleration of religion. You could believe what you liked. And promoted people in the army, not because of their social position, because of their merit, because of their ability. And he was accused by some people, you recruited Anabaptists. And Anabaptists were like communists, the name of communists. You know? And he said, I don't care. They'll fight better for it. Their enthusiasm as Anabaptists will be better. They'll fight more enthusiastically. And he drew around them the most fervent, not only enthusiasm to challenge the king, but also the most dedicated religious fanatics, if you like, in the best sense of the word. In fact, he said that Cromwell mentioned that the reason for this war was not religion, by the way, he said, which is true. Although, given the times, religion played an important role, as did politics and everything else. And behind religion was the class struggle. And he said that he believed in that people should be promoted, not because of their birth. I'll give you a quote from Cromwell. I think it's reasonably easy to translate. I would rather have a plain courted captain. I'd rather have a plain ordinary captain that knows what he's fighting for and loves what he does than a man you call a gentleman. And is nothing else but a gentleman. And they used to, you'd get the men together, and they would sing, psalms. They'd have religious songs. But to show he was a bit of a materialist, he explained to his men, put your faith in God, but keep your gunpowder dry. And Cromwell looked with disdain on these other generals who were leading the parliamentary side, you know, with their big hats and the lords of the manor. And one of these lords, which is the Earl of Manchester, his name was, the Earl of Manchester, one of the big parliamentary lords, he said to Cromwell, if we beat the king 99 times, he's still the king, So basically you say, well, you know, even if he beat him all the time, you know, he's still going to be the king. So Cromwell says, my lord, if that is so, why did we take up arms in the first place? Well, I got a number of quotes here from Cromwell, but they're just to show, but I'll have to just paraphrase them. He said, look, if I meet the king on the battlefield, I will shoot him through the heart. If he a king or an ordinary man, I don't care. And he said to his men, if your conscience refuses you to do this act, then you have no place in my army. Out. So Cromwell based himself on enthusiasm, of religious conviction, of purpose, and of promoting those who had talent to the top. And he scored enormous victories against the royalists on this basis. Because when the royalists attacked, after they attacked, they used to look for plunder, you know, look for things to steal. And whereas when Cromwell's army attacked, it was very disciplined, self-disciplined, knew what he was doing. And after, 3 years of civil war, Cromwell had earned himself an enormous reputation now throughout the whole of the land. And he managed to in Parliament, to get a decision, to get a resolution through Parliament in 1645, to completely reorganize the army. All the lords, all the generals should be dismissed, and new officers elected, and everything should be based upon what he had, his experience in his regiment. And the new name of the army was the New Model Army. And the general in charge was a man called Fairfax, Lord Fairfax. And Cromwell was put in as the second in command. Although in reality, Cromwell, I think, called the shots. You know, he was the decisive influence. And within 12 months, they defeated the royalists, smashed them. I should also describe a bit. Trotsky explains in his book on Britain that the army, this new model army, was more than an army. It was a political party. And it was made up of the most dedicated revolutionaries. Parliament by this time, right, was still in session. Parliament was still continuing. But Parliament was made up largely of the big bourgeoisie. The army was largely built up on the petty bourgeoisie. And the name of the parliamentarians, the dominant big bourgeois, were called Presbyterians. Although Protestant, they were more of a conservative Protestantism. And the army was called the Independents. And they were fervent Calvinists. They believed that they were the elite and nothing could stop them. They were invincible. That's what gave them their enthusiasm, their conviction to fight. And therefore you had this conflict all the time between Parliament, the big bourgeoisie, and Cromwell leading the petty bourgeoisie in this struggle. Charles I managed to escape, and he ran away to Scotland. Actually, he was captured by the Scots. And as all good Scotsmen do, they sold Charles to Parliament. Like £200,000, it wasn't bad in those days. One king going cheap. But Parliament wanted to negotiate now with the king, with Charles. During the Civil War, they didn't want to win the Civil War. The New Model Army did. They were one all-out win the war. Parliament, let's compromise. Again, reflecting the class interests involved. In fact, you'll find in the French Revolution, the American Revolution, the most enthusiastic and revolutionary were the revolutionary petty bourgeois, not the bourgeoisie. Although they were carrying through a bourgeois revolution, the bourgeoisie didn't play the role. And there was two things. First of all, they wanted to negotiate with the king in order for him to be a nice man, you know, be good. Secondly, the Parliament didn't like the army at all. They didn't like Cromwell and they didn't like the army. It was costing them too much money. But more importantly than the money, the army was made up of fanatics, religious fanatics. Now, when I say religious fanatics, you have to understand that in the 17th century, religion was a cloak for politics. It was a cover for politics. And amongst the rank and file of the army, they got their own preachers, and they were preaching all sorts of things. heaven on earth, for instance, you know. Equality, not just in religion, but in wealth. All sorts of things, all these religious revolutionary ideas. Oh, Christ Almighty. Imagine the big bourgeoisie were terrified that these people would get a big majority and take away their wealth. In fact, even within the independents, even within the New Model Army, there was a division. Mainly between the officers, even though they were, most of them were elected, and the rank and file, the ordinary soldiers and cavalrymen. First of all, the Parliament, the bourgeoisie in Parliament, wanted to disband the army. You've done the job, now disband, for God's sake, go home. Even better, there was an uprising in Ireland. Go to Ireland, get out of the way. Funny thing, they owed them back money, they refused to give them any back money, and they refused to give them any indemnity, you know, for the actions in the Civil War. They refused to say, well, everything was okay. We did it because of the cause. They weren't prepared to say that. So as you can imagine, there was enormous discontent in the army amongst the rank and file. And they were to regularly hear these preachers preaching for heaven on earth and revolution on earth and in the name of Christ. They were getting very radical. And here's another interesting figure who has been forgotten in English history. A man called John Lilburn, who was a real character, and fighting, obviously fighting against injustices. In fact, in 1637, before the Civil War, there were several Puritan leaders were arrested by Charles I for treason and sedition. And the sentence was life imprisonment. But before you went to prison, they decided to put you in the stocks, you know, put you in the, lock you up, the stocks, the contraption, the stock. And the next part of the sentence was they should have all the ears cut off. So cut the ears off. And then they branded them on the forehead. They got the hot iron and branded them on the forehead. So they give it before in the stocks. They made an appeal, you know, this is a scandal and so on. And one of the young persons in the audience was this John Lilburn. He was only 22 at the time. So he decides to write down what they said and distribute it, you know. So he was distributing what the Protestant preachers were talking about. So he was immediately arrested and sent to this Star Chamber, the highest court in the land, to be tried. So he turned up and says, well, I don't recognize this court. I'm not going to say a word. So he was sentenced to be whipped, lashed from Fleet Street, which is the center of, well, I don't know where, from Fleet Street, East London, all the way to Parliament. They'd lash him all the way. And big crowds turned out to cheer him, you know, to support him because he was defiant. He earned a name for himself as someone who stood out. And he was called, and his nickname was Honest John Lilburn. But during this period, during the 1640s, the state apparatus broke down. As I imagine, the Civil War, the state just disintegrated, the old state. Censorship, which was very, very strict, all broke down. So there were hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of pamphlets were produced illegally on printing presses and distributed in the army, amongst the population, everything. And preachers, which were put in prison before because their radicalism, were now brought out and they were speaking everywhere. John Lilburn was in favor of religious toleration, freedom of conscience, even including Catholics, he said, which was a real, very difficult thing to say at that time. But even Catholics, he said, should have the right to preach what they want. Because of his activities, Lilburn was in prison most of his life. I think he was in and out of prison. In fact, Oliver Cromwell, when he made his maiden speech in Parliament in 1640, called for John Lilburn to be released. But Lilburn didn't compromise with anybody and joined the New Model Army, became a very courageous soldier. And after the Civil War was over in 1645, he went straight to London to agitate amongst the population. And above all, attack the ruling council, county, the city council of London, which were really, you know, big bourgeois bureaucrats and stuff. But these ideas, these revolutionary ideas, had a big echo within the army, within the new model army, amongst the rank and file. And they grew up a movement in 1647 known as the Levellers. The Levellers. And the Levellers, as you can imagine, the Level Society, wasn't a name that they chose, it was a name that the Royalists gave them, that these people were communists, they were Levellers. And they drew up a revolutionary document called the Agreement of the People, which is like a new constitution for Britain or England after the war. And those who could vote for people in Parliament, Parliament represented the landowning class, and the people who voted for them were had to have property, had to have quite a bit of property. In other words, he was a privileged elite. But the Levellers came forward and said, every male adult of the age of 21 should be able to vote. But they would exclude royalists, which is very progressive, vagabonds, servants, even workers. I'll explain the reason why. They believed that the vote should be given to every independent man. Women weren't excluded, were excluded from the vote for them. The reason being they were dependent upon their men. Women were dependent upon their husband, therefore they shouldn't have the vote because they would only vote the same way as their husband. That was the logic, right? The working class at this stage was tiny. It was infinitesimal. It hardly existed. But they were concerned that the people should vote were independent, not dependent on other people who could influence them to vote. But that would be a revolution in itself. They set up a parliament on that basis. In the army, the revolutionary movements resulted in every regiment selecting representatives called agitators. They could select two officers and two rank and file. This first came from the cavalry, but then spread to the troops, the ordinary troops. And they demanded of Cromwell and the lead and the officers that they meet, because they were not a mercenary army. As they said, it was a very famous proclamation. They were not mercenaries. But this army was called into being by the people of England to defend the rights and privileges of the people of England. And we will not disband. Well, that was quite in other words, there's mutiny in the army. Cromwell is forced to call an army council. But before doing so, the army marches on London and purges Parliament, kicks out the big bourgeoisie. And they were encamped in London in a place called Putney. If you know the borough of Putney, that's where they were encamped. And in late October, early November, 1649, they held a general council meeting in a church in Putney, in St. Mary's Church in Putney, still there now. Incredible, really, because the soldiers said, to the officers, you can come if you want, but we're going to have this council. And the officers were afraid, and they came in with the ranks in order to keep control. Some people have called this like a Soviet, insofar as it had the ranks of the army delegates to come to this place. Not only did they invite the ranks, they invited representatives of the Leveller Party to come to this debate, this discussion. So this event, 350 years ago, was a revolutionary council to decide the fate of Britain and the constitution of Britain. And the chairman of this meeting was Oliver Cromwell. And he said, anybody here can speak their mind. You're free to speak what you want. And the first man who got up was a man called Sexby. He was a rank and file agitator from one of the regiments. And he demanded this council draw up a constitution that give the people of England the right to vote, the right to vote for Parliament. All those over 21 years of age should be able to vote. He attacked the grandees, he attacked the officer caste. Cromwell was a bit taken aback at the time. And it opened up a debate for several days in this church, debating the fate of the monarchy, the fate of the constitution, and who should have the right to vote. In fact, you'll find in the bookshop, there's a book there most of the debate, the proceedings of the debate was taken down in shorthand. One of the radical officers got up, Colonel Rainsborough, and he said, the poorest he in England must have the same right to live as the greatest he. In other words, the poorest people should have the same right to live as the rich people. And one of the leading generals, Ireton, came in and said, if you give the right to vote the people without property, they will vote to take the property away from the people who got the property. Well, they weren't stupid. They knew exactly what the score was. Once you put power into the hands of people, the common people, then they will change the whole class nature of society in their interests. At the end of the debate, there was a vote taken to extend the franchise, three people against the extension. In other words, in favour of the extension, everybody else. You get that? Three people were opposed to giving the right to vote to people. At the end, they were told, look, we have to disband and go back to our regiments and have meetings of the regiments. And the Levellers thought they had gained a victory. They thought, this is it, we've gained. But Cromwell was afraid that this would bring disunity into the army, and therefore wanted to oppose it, oppose these measures. There were three meetings called of the regiments, and he went to the first regiment, and soldiers were wearing in their helmets copies of the agreement of the people. And Cromwell had to use every ounce of his authority to win them over to the idea we needed unity in order to make sure that the royalists are defeated. And he asked for the agreements to be taken out of the office of the hats of the people who were in front of him. They actually refused, and Cromwell rode in and actually took them. Whatever you think about Cromwell, he was a very, very, how can I say, determined, courageous individual, very single-minded, one aim. Nothing should be defected from this aim. This action created a mutiny in this regiment. 14 of the ringleaders were arrested. 3 were found guilty of treason. And they drew lots. 3 people drew lots. You know, drew a lot. They would decide amongst themselves who was going to be shot. Mm-hmm. In other words, Cromwell was determined to put down the mutiny to ensure unity in the ranks behind him. The good news from his point of view is that the king was held by Parliament, had escaped. He was under house arrest, or mansion arrest, you know, and he escaped. Whereas the Levellers had raised the idea of a republic in Britain, Cromwell had the idea of negotiation, didn't have the idea of the republic at this point. A second civil war broke out in 1648. The royalists were quickly defeated after a period of 6 months. And the king was captured once again. The king was recaptured. This time, Cromwell had lost patience with the king. And above all, the ranks of the army were determined to get vengeance. They wanted to get rid of the king. A court was constituted to try the king. He was going to be tried for treason for the civil war crimes. And in January 1649, he was sentenced to death on the 27th of January. And on the 30th of January, he was taken to a scaffold outside the banqueting hall in central London and was beheaded. There was even, this was an incredible thing to do, to actually murder the king, to kill the king. Even those who had to sign the death warrant, there were 70 people had to sign the death warrant, and Cromwell had to come and grab someone's arm and force him down to sign the warrant. So events happened very quickly after that. The king was beheaded at the end of January. On the 6th of February, the House of Lords was abolished, called this unnecessary and dangerous body. A day later, kingship was abolished in England. Kingship. And on the 19th of May was declared the Free Commonwealth, the Republic, the Free Republic. Although this seemed to be an enormous turn of events, there was still enormous discontent within the army itself. They'd not eradicated this discontent. And in the centre of London, in the Hyde Park, Cromwell reviewed the troops of the model army, and they were wearing the sea green bands on their arms and their helmets of the levellers. Basically, Cromwell believed that the situation was too critical to allow the luxury of debate and discussion and differences. And he believed that this ferment in the army needed to be disciplined. But there was at that time a mutiny broke out in the south of England, in Salisbury, where one of the regiments had come out for the levellers' demands and were marching to meet other regiments in the north. Cromwell and Fairfax immediately gathered an army to march to oppose them. And they were surrounded in a place called Burford. And they were asked to surrender, which they did. But several of the leaders were tried with treason on the spot. And they were shot in the churchyard of Burford. That was called the last stand of the levellers. At this time, there was even a more radical movement than the levellers existing, which called themselves the true levellers. And these true levellers were known colloquially, alone in slang terms, as the diggers. And they were led by a man called Gerard Winstanley. And they were more communist in their views. They believed there should be no private property, that all trade should be banned. All trade should be banned. That the earth should be the common property of everyone. Again, Winstanley's writings are on sale. Unreadable. Good commercial break. But they were obviously utopian demands in the sense of they were well in advance of their time. And they went down to St. George Hill in, Berkshire. And they took over the common land that existed. And hundreds of people started to till the common land, to plow the land, to sow the land. Other digger settlements were established in different parts of the country. And they had this idea that they would attract all those people who were working on the Lord's lands to come and work on the common lands for themselves. And if the Lords didn't have anybody to till their land, then they would collapse. That was the idea. And eventually everybody would have this common land and would be working a common way. Only one slight problem. You know, the state didn't want this. This was subversion. And that the regiments of the Model Army were sent in order to put down St. George Hill commune. By this time, John Lilburn had moved into London, was spreading lots of sedition amongst the people of London. The only thing is that the revolution had gone to its high point, reached its high point. The bourgeois revolution had succeeded. They destroyed the old order, destroyed the monarchy, destroyed the state apparatus. And now sold off all the royalist lands have been sold off as well. Only thing that the army rested on quite a narrow social base. And there were many threats to the revolution, not only from abroad, but also internally. The parliament had been repeatedly purged, became more and more a revolutionary minority. The great historical figure of Cromwell should not be undermined, in my opinion, because of his actions against the levellers or the diggers and so on. After all, he didn't represent their interests. He didn't represent the interests of the common people. He represented the interests of the revolutionary petty bourgeois. And as a result, he had no concern for any kind of tradition or ritual. He was not interested in that. For instance, when he walked in, they marched into Parliament, and the Speaker had the mace, you know, the parliamentary mace, which is kind of a symbol of Parliament, you know. And Cromwell just grabbed hold of it and threw it aside and said, "I have no time for baubles. I have no time for trinkets. I have no time for jewellery. If a thing was needed, fine. If it wasn't needed, then to hell with it." And that's why in 1653, the Parliament itself was dissolved and they created a protectorate, a dictatorship in England, a military dictatorship. And this happens on occasions, as we know. when the interests, the class interests of one particular class and the certain conditions can be reflected in the dictatorship of one man even. And such was the dangers that circled the revolution internally and externally. But Cromwell believed it was only through military dictatorship could the revolution survive. In 1658, Cromwell died, and his son took over the protectorate. His name was Richard, and he was a very wavering individual. So he had a nickname called Rickety Dick, which you can't actually put it. Dick is short for Richard, and Rickety is, very unstable. Rickety Dick. But the class basis of the revolution was very, very narrow at this time under the dictatorship. And above all, the bourgeoisie did not want the army dictatorship. They didn't really, the big bourgeoisie were found it too costly. And you can see that the revolution begins to unwind. And even some of the revolutionary elements who gained lands now by the sale of royalist lands, they became very wealthy and became big bourgeois. And therefore, after Cromwell's death, there was this, they put out the feelers, they put out the idea of a compromise being reached and the bring him back of Charles II to the throne. And that's exactly what happened. General Monk staged a march on London, established a free parliament, a so-called free parliament, and in May 1660, Charles II was restored to the throne. The restoration waged a white reaction against the revolutionaries, former revolutionaries. All those who had signed the death warrant were now charged with treason for regicide, murder of kings. Oliver Cromwell's body was dug up and hung. He was only a skeleton. They hung him on the bridge, the Tyburn Bridge, as a warning of what would happen to these who challenged the monarchy again. But things had changed. This was not 1640. Although the bishops came back, they didn't have the same powers. The royalists didn't get all their lands back. And above all, the king was subordinate to Parliament. This was a compromise of the landed, privileged, big bourgeoisie and the aristocracy. But the aristocracy now began to adapt to capitalism. Although there were a few skirmishes after this, James II, for instance, tried to bring back a bit more powers, and he was overthrown by William of Orange in 1688, the Glorious Revolution, as the bourgeois call it. I think it's Thomas Carlyle who wrote a book about Oliver Cromwell, this 19th century historian. Thomas Carlyle wrote a book about Oliver Cromwell. And he said before he could begin, he had to rescue Oliver Cromwell from a mountain of dead dogs. The big bourgeoisie did not want to remember the Civil War and the English Revolution. It was a bad, bad memory. Even the name British Republic was null and void. They didn't use that term. They called it the interregnum, the space between one thing and another. And this laid the basis then of a new commercial government, a government based on the interests of the big bourgeoisie, which then in turn led to the Industrial Revolution and the British Empire. But for us, the revolution has enormous lessons. Whereas the troops of the new model army had their conviction in religion, Trotsky says, we are the real Ironsiders. We are the real model army of the proletariat. But our conviction is not based on religious fanaticism. Our enthusiasm and drive is based on materialism of Marxism. But we have to have, the courage and the elan and the enthusiasm of the bourgeois revolution, of the English bourgeois revolution. And from our point of view, we look forward to the beheading of Charles I or whatever, our own king in the future. That was a joke. Anyway, right out of time. Thank you very much.